Good afternoon. Ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices. My role is just to introduce Mark Rifkin of the Wolf Holdenstein firm, who will be handling the argument for the appellees.
Welcome to the court, Mr. Rifkin.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Alan Terrell for Appellant Witt Capital. And I'd like to introduce to the court John N. Thomas, the law firm of Morgan, Lewis & Bacchus, a member of the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut Bar, has been admitted for the purposes of the argument.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Today to discuss whether the Superior Court erred in certifying a class, actually four subclasses, in connection with plaintiff's breach of contract claim, which is now the sole claim left in this case after decisions by the late Judge Alford, this court, and now Judge Johnston. Trying to certify a class action for plaintiff's breach of contract claim is like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. It simply doesn't work. The Superior Court attempted to get around this problem by creating four subclasses, but that didn't solve the problem. This is simply not a case which is suitable for class action treatment, and the Superior Court erred in several respects in certifying the four subclasses. Each one of the errors warrants reversal. But the one that is the most stark and the most clearly dispositive concerns the predominance of individual issues on liability. Now, it's the key issue because the law is clear, the facts are clear, and the result is dispositive. It was also the critical issue below, yet the Superior Court's order simply never addresses it. Now, Rule 23b-3, which is the rule which plaintiffs are seeking certification under, requires that in order to certify a class action, common legal and factual questions must predominate individual ones. Now, here that requirement has not been met, and it cannot be met. Briefly, this is a case brought by former customers of Witt Capital. Witt Capital was an online brokerage firm which offered as a service to its customers the opportunity to participate in IPO allocations, something that's not normally open to the everyday consumer. Now, Witt Capital received only a fraction of the shares for any one IPO, and because demand always outstrips supply, they endeavored to allocate the shares on a first-come, first-served basis, but it was a zero-sum game. And Witt Capital utilized certain filters, the nature of which are in dispute in this case, to assist in that process. Now, plaintiffs allege that Witt Capital had a contractual obligation to employ four specific filters, and that because Witt Capital allegedly failed to employ these four specific filters, certain customers who were otherwise qualified did not receive the allocations. Now, while much of that's in dispute and is premised on a faulty assumption, even assuming it's true, the plaintiffs are left with a glaring problem, and that is, this is a breach of contract claim. It's governed by New York law. To establish liability for a breach of contract claim under New York law, a plaintiff must prove that the breach caused injury. Phrased otherwise, proof of the fact of injury is necessary to prove liability for the breach of contract claim. Here, this cannot be done on a class-wide basis. And that's because not receiving an allocation, even if it was due to a breach, does not necessarily mean that anyone was injured by that breach. The only way to know whether a customer would have been injured by failing to receive an allocation is to determine whether or not that customer would have made or lost money on the stock he or she didn't actually get. And the only way to answer that is to find out when, and thus at what price, the customer would have sold the stock that he or she actually did not receive. And the only way to determine when a customer would sell a stock is to ask. Now, under those circumstances, class certification is just not appropriate. As our expert, Dr. Alan Clyden, explained in two separate expert reports, neither of which is ever rebutted by the plaintiffs, because investment decisions are inherently individual. There is simply no way to objectively determine on a class-wide basis when any particular customer or set of customers will sell a particular stock. And the law is clear that in that situation, certification is not appropriate, because under those circumstances, individual issues of liability will predominate. It's important to recognize the distinction here the law makes between liability or fact of injury, which is what I'm talking about, and the amount of damages or the calculation of damages, which I am not. And the Third Circuit's decision in Merrill Lynch v. Newton explains this distinction well. Newton involved the claim breach of the duty of best execution. In other words, the allegations were that the defendants didn't always get the best possible price for the customers. And the Third Circuit made it clear that that case was not like a securities fraud in the market case, where reliance can be presumed. Nor was it like an antitrust case, like, for instance, In re NASDAQ Market Makers antitrust litigation, which Newton specifically discusses, where economic loss can be presumed because price fixing presumptively affects all purchasers. Instead, the Third Circuit held that determining whether customers were in fact injured would depend upon the facts of each trade. In other words, for any particular customer, was a better price available when they tried to trade? If one was, then they were injured. If one was not, they were not. And the Third Circuit was unequivocal that when proof of an essential element of a claim requires individual treatment, then certification is not appropriate. Therefore, because individual issues of liability existed in that case, they predominated and certification was found not to be appropriate. And to reiterate a point I made before, the Newton Court made it clear that fact of injury, liability, is a different animal than the issue of amount of damages, the latter of which does not necessarily preclude certification, whereas the former does. Now, in short, because fact of injury in a case like ours cannot be established on a class-wide basis, certification is not appropriate.
Let me try to oversimplify it, and I'm happy to be corrected. The allocation was for a price certain, wasn't it?
Yes.
And everyone who got an allocation would have paid the same price, and if they didn't get an allocation, they lost the opportunity to buy the stock at that price, correct?
The price that was open on the trade date, yes.
So what is the individualization of the injury, as a matter of fact, under those circumstances? Why is that important to certification here?
Okay. If you receive a stock, you have it. The only way to know whether or not you were injured by not receiving the stock is to find out if you would have made or lost money having received it. The only way to know that is to find out when you would have sold stock. Because if you sold the stock when it was at a higher price, then you were injured by the difference between what you paid and what you could have received. If the stock went down in price, which the plaintiffs alleged they did invariably after a couple months, then you would have lost money on the stock. That is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about this, the injury here that needs to be proved. Now, the Huang v. E-Trade case, which we rely upon, applied Newton and other federal cases to reverse the trial court's decision, which had, as below here, erroneously certified a class in a case similar to this one. Huang also involved an online brokerage firm, which was alleged to have breached contractual duties to its customers in connection with the trading of securities. The court there found that the trading of customers who were affected by E-Trade's alleged contractual failings would have to be analyzed on a trade-by-trade basis. In other words, to determine whether customers were in fact injured as opposed to having benefited from the contractual failings would require determining at what price the customers would have traded after the breach of contract. Now, because that involved inherently individualized questions, the court there too found certification to be inappropriate and it reversed. Now, Huang is on all fours with our case. There as here, customers were seeking to engage in securities transactions. There as here, customers were unable to do so because of alleged breaches of contract by the online brokerage firm. There as here, customers could establish a claim only if they could show they would have made money from the lost opportunity, which I think gets to your point, so I hope it does.
All right, so just to make sure that I have your point, for this purpose, we can hypothesize that there's a group of customers of Witt Capital that should have received the opportunity to buy stock at a given price on, let's say, day one, whenever that is.
I'm assuming that for purposes of this point, yes.
Your argument is that there would have to be a separate inquiry for each customer as to whether they would have sold on day two or day three or day four or day 24. And, of course, the sales price might differ on any or all of those days because the market conditions would change. And those are individualized determinations that would overwhelm whatever commonality of issues might exist. Is that your argument?
You phrased it perfectly. Yes, that's exactly my point.
Let's assume that's right. Isn't it still the case that the first element of the cause of action, that is, whether there was a breach of contract, wouldn't that be amenable to class action treatment?
I don't dispute that. That could presumably be a common question for the class.
So it wouldn't have to be litigated on behalf of each member, a putative member of the class, that is, whether there was a breach of contract, or that is, whether they had contract rights that were violated.
Whether a duty existed under the contract, and whether Witt Capital followed or didn't follow that particular process, and therefore presumably or hypothetically created a breach, I'm not suggesting is an individualized inquiry. What I am saying is that when individualized questions exist for an element, an essential element of a claim, and what I'm talking about now is the liability or fact of injury, that alone predominates the common questions. And that's what Newton stood for, and that's what the Huang case stood for. And the final point I was going to make on that is the final point on the connection between Huang and this case is that in making a determination of whether or not people would have made or lost money would require looking at the facts and circumstances of each individual customer to determine when they would have sold. Now, plaintiffs don't have a response to this line of cases, nor to our expert's report, at least not a serious one. That fact of injury is a distinct question from the amount of damages is not open to dispute. That the existence of individual questions going to fact of injury or liability is likewise not open to dispute. And that individual fact of injury questions on liability exist in this case is also not in dispute. And the plaintiffs have not because they cannot rebut this.
Well, they're saying that the objective data that your client has will answer the questions that... And you're saying you have to ask the individual investor.
Well, I'll let Mr. Rifkin address this point. I'm sure he will. They're saying that the data exists to show who could have been in the class, perhaps what the process was, and who didn't get the shares. I'm not disputing that necessarily. What I'm talking about, assume that's all true. Assume the data can tell you who was in the, you know, who got the shares, who didn't get the shares, what the process was, and perhaps who was qualified but did not. That only gets you so far. That does not answer the question of whether or not assuming they should have received the shares if they would have made or lost money. That's my point. The data, there is no data which can show that. Quite simply, the individual issues of liability exist in this case and therefore they predominate. On that basis alone, which cannot be cured, this court should reverse.
Well, would it work that, let's say, a series of investors who had received shares before generally sold within 2 weeks? I mean, would that be a methodology that could be used to predict behavior?
As our expert points out, it's not possible to figure out when any particular person will sell a share. Investors buy and sell for a whole host of very individual reasons based on their trading patterns, their philosophy for trading securities, their economic circumstances. So it's not possible ahead of time to look forward and say any group of people would have sold 2 weeks out or a month out or 2 months out. It's just not supported by the data.
It is possible for an individual claim to proceed, though, on the basis that there would be sufficient facts for the plaintiff to establish that I had a predetermined date on which I would have had to sell. I would have sold on that date, and I would have made a profit had I sold on that date. Is that the distinction? You might be able to fulfill the last element of the New York breach of contract claim by proving fact of injury in an individual shareholder situation. But you can't apply those principles across the board to everyone.
Precisely. An individual could do it. If the Bennings or the other named plaintiffs have an arbitration, for instance, and they come in and they get past the first couple of hurdles and they get to this liability point, and they can convincingly demonstrate to the trier of fact that they would have sold at some particular date, then they have a claim. My point is that is an individual issue, and it will predominate in this case because it would require many files for every single person who's in the class to determine when they would have sold and if they would have made or lost money.
And if those individual trials did take place, undoubtedly your client would be arguing face of testimony or proffered testimony by these customers that testimony as to when they would have sold is inherently speculative and shouldn't be admitted.
Well, we would argue that, yes.
So there's a catch-22 in any event.
Well, I suggest that the problems are both on their end. I'm only working with what I have. I'm going to try to wrap up quickly here because I want to save some time. Very quickly on superiority, and I'll short-circuit this a bit. It's a second requirement under Rule 23b-3, but it's not a difficult issue here because the cases are clear, and they are many, that when you have a predominance of individual issues, a class action is unmanageable. In other words, it's not superior almost by definition when you have an existence of individual issues of liability. And there are many cases which would state that, which we have in our brief. The bottom line is that when predominance is not met, neither is superiority. I'll wrap up now. We have other points in our brief, typicality, numerosity, the nature of the definitions themselves, which I think are very strong points, but given the amount of time I have, I'll leave those to our papers, which I think handle them well. I'll end with this point. Each of our points in appeal, individually and collectively, come back to the same central problem which I indicated at the beginning, which is this is like putting a square peg in a round hole. Phrased otherwise, this is a case where class action treatment is simply not workable. And that's what all of our points come down to, with predominance of liability issues being the biggest and most dispositive of all. On that basis, we'll ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Your Honors, good afternoon. My name is Mark Rifkin, and I represent the four individual plaintiffs, Arthur Benning Sr., his wife, Barbara Lee Benning, their son, Arthur Benning Jr., and a complete stranger to the Bennings, as far as I know, Janessa Dabler. I also represent the class of shareholders that they also seek to represent. The court has addressed a question about this proof of damages, which I would like to respond to immediately. I think it's clearly it's an issue that WIC considers important, and I gather from the court's questions that the court understands it to be an important issue as well. I would like to point out that WIC has made what I think are two very significant concessions in their argument. The first is a concession that the question whether the contract imposed duties upon WIC is a common question that is amenable to treatment on a class-wide basis. There was one single contract for all 71,000 customers of WIC Capital. It was not the case that some customers executed one account agreement and other customers executed another account agreement. It was not the case that some account agreements had some provisions in them that other account agreements did not have. They were identical, and the scope of WIC's duties, whatever they may have been, are in fact identical with respect to all of the members. We think it was clear from the account agreements that WIC was obligated to distribute IPO shares on a first-come, first-served basis to its customers who sought to reserve them. We think WIC provided in the account agreements that it would give preference to individual customers who refrained from selling their shares during a 60-day period of time. We call that the anti-flipping rule because I think that's what WIC called it. But with those exceptions, we think WIC had really very little rules in their contract. We think what happened is that WIC simply didn't do its job in allocating. It was the only job WIC did. WIC contracted out all of the other aspects of running a brokerage firm to third parties. For example, the orders were placed not with WIC, but with a third-party vendor called Kingland Systems. The accounts were maintained not by WIC, but by a third-party vendor called ADP. The trades were executed not by WIC, but by a third-party vendor called U.S. Clearing Corporation.
Are you arguing the merits of your contract claim?
No.
I'm having trouble following.
No, Your Honor, not at all. My point is this. WIC's only job, the only thing WIC did was this issue of allocation, and the point that I'm trying to make is that WIC has now conceded that what their allocation obligations were is an issue that's amenable to class treatment. WIC has also conceded that whether Witt breached any of those duties is also an issue that's amenable to class treatment. The only issue that Witt raises now, or at least has addressed in the argument, is whether the ultimate amount of damages is of such significance that it would swallow up what would otherwise be the common issues in this class action. And I would like to address why I think that's not. We argued in our brief two points. First, we argued that the question of damages, the amount of damages, is not an issue that defeats class certification. And courts historically have taken that point of view. This issue of the question of damages as opposed to the measure of damages, we responded to as follows. There is no question that if you had the right to buy shares of stock in an initial public offering at the offering price, which was, let's say, $20, and thereafter the price of that stock immediately rose in the aftermarket to, let's say, $25 or $30, there's no question that you have been harmed, because if you still want to buy that stock, and in all of these instances where Witt sold these IPOs, in the immediate aftermarket following the issuance of the stock, every one of these more than 70 cases rose in value. If a shareholder, if a customer of Witt wanted to buy stock in a particular IPO after the initial public offering, he or she could do so only at a market price that was higher than the IPO price. We also addressed in the court below where this question of the measure of damages was more directly addressed. We addressed it by raising a decision from this court called Duncan versus, I hope I get the last name right, Theratix, T-H-E-R-A-T-X. Theratix maybe is how you pronounce it. But in Duncan versus Theratix, the question was put to the court. It was a certified question from out of state. The question was put to this court. In a situation where a stock restriction prevents a plaintiff from selling his shares, is there a way to objectively measure the damages that that plaintiff would be entitled to, given the fact that he could not sell his shares and you could not have a purchase at a particular price and a sale at another price against which to measure the damages? Your Honor, in opening the question, Chief Justice Steele, I believe you asked the question, isn't it the case that everyone would have purchased at the same price? Yes, in fact, if they were all properly allocated shares in the IPO, they all would have purchased the stock of each of these different companies at the IPO price. Thereafter, the stock immediately rose. How long it stayed high and how far it fell, these are questions that differ from company to company to company, but in all 70 cases, the same pattern arose. In Duncan versus Theratix, the issue was as follows. The plaintiff had the right to buy or sell stock pursuant to a shelf registration statement that the defendant was obligated to maintain open. The defendant breached that obligation. The shelf registration statement was withdrawn. The plaintiff lost the ability to sell. This court was asked to decide, is there an objective measure of damages? And this court concluded, yes, there was, and said as follows. It says, we conclude that under Delaware law, at least, contract damages in this situation are measured by calculating the difference between the highest intermediate price of the shares during a reasonable time at the beginning of the restricted period and then subtracting from it the average market price of the shares during a reasonable time after the restrictions are lifted. The point of the Duncan case is that it is not necessary to ask each and every member of this class, when would you have sold? When would you have sold? When would you have sold? This court decided that it is appropriate to substitute a reasonable measure of that sale damages, and held and instructed the court that certified it, the 11th Circuit, and held that at least under Delaware law, it would be appropriate to measure damages in that way.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions. On that point, that case dealt with a restricted period.
Yes.
And what effect does that have in this situation when anyone who might have gotten their allocated shares saw the shares go to 22, someone might say, wow, that's a 10% profit, I'm taking it. Someone else may have said, oh, it's going up, I'm going to wait till 25. Someone who's handling the shares, perhaps with someone else, may have some restrictions on the period of time in which they must hold the stock or not.
Correct.
There are a myriad of different reasons why shareholders might sell. Now,
given that as a factual possibility, I think we'd all agree on, I'm a little lost on whether the phrase fact of injury under New York law is the same thing as measure of damages. The argument, as I understood it from the other side, was fact of injury is an element of a breach of contract claim. It's highly individualized in this particular situation. You're talking about how one measures damages.
Correct.
Unconfuse me about the distinction, if there is one, between fact of injury as an element of a breach of contract claim and measure of damages.
We thought that our response in the brief was simply this. The fact of injury is established because if you asked, for example, if you asked, as one of our plaintiffs did, to purchase Net Perception, which was one of the 70 IPOs that WIT distributed, if you asked to purchase Net Perception and you should have received an allocation of the Net Perception stock, but you did not, the Net Perception IPO went public at, let's say again to use that same example, it wasn't the price, but let's use it because we have already said $20. If you did not get the chance to buy Net Perception at the IPO offering price, you were injured because your next opportunity to buy Net Perception was on the first trade after the IPO, which would have been at $20+, whether it was 21 or 22 or 25 or 30 or 80, one never knows.
So your answer to the Chief Justice's question is that the fact of damages is established by proof of the initial IPO price and the fact that in the immediate aftermarket the price went up.
That's correct.
And then the other issue is how much damage each individual suffered.
Your Honor, that is exactly correct. The fact of damages is established because we have alleged, and it is the case, and no one denies it nor can, that every one of these stocks came out at an IPO price that was substantially less than the first available trade price in the immediate aftermarket. Not a single one of them is an exception.
So your position is that's enough to presume injury in fact for every single investor?
Your Honor, I think what it does is it satisfies any requirement that there be injury in fact. I'm not suggesting that that would be the absolute appropriate measure of damages, but it satisfies the question whether there were in fact any damages, which I understand was the focus of WIT's presentation today. It was an element they raised in their brief, but in every single one of these cases, if you did not get shares of stock in the IPO, your next purchase was at a price greater than the IPO. WIT cannot deny that. WIT has not denied it, and WIT will not deny that, because those are the simple facts in all 70 of these cases.
So you have, under your approach, class issues as to the existence of contractual duties, the breach of a contractual duty, and the fact of damages. But nonetheless, don't you still have an individualized inquiry when we get to the issue of how much damage each class member suffered? And how would a class be manageable in light of that necessity?
And Your Honor, I think you've asked the question that perhaps I was trying to answer before, and that relates to this substituted sale that we think the Duncan case permits. In every one of these instances, what we're now talking about is a customer who says, I was denied the opportunity to purchase at price X. If I purchased, and many of them may have, if I purchased, I purchased at price Y, which was greater than price X. I've already been injured by that much. Some of them may say, I also would have sold at price Z, which may have been greater still. We think Duncan helps us there because Duncan lets us look at a period of time and say this is an objective period of time in which you would have disposed of the stock, and we can measure damages as the full value between price X, which was the IPO price, and price Z, which is this imputed sale price under Duncan. But I don't mean to say that that's the only conceivable measure of damages.
That's a hypothetical
formula. That is one measure of damages. It's a hypothetical formula, but it's the formula that this court said in Duncan is an appropriate measure of damages when a shareholder is denied the opportunity to sell. Now, let me respond to the question about the restriction, because in this case, we had a restriction too. WIT required all of its shareholders to agree to refrain from selling whatever shares of IPO stock they did receive for a period of 60 days. This was this flipping period. They said, if you receive these shares, you must refrain from selling your shares for 60 days. WIT cannot, as a matter of law, stop its customers from selling shares. It is obligated as a broker-dealer to execute whatever trades its customer instructs it to execute. However, Witt said, if you do execute trades during that restricted period, that 60-day restricted period, you will lose your preference in all subsequent IPO offerings. That's the anti-flipper preference that Witt provided to those who refrain from selling. Now, you may be wondering why that is. The answer is because in order for Witt to receive an allocation of IPOs from the underwriters who were taking these companies public, Witt had to agree as a term of it receiving an allocation that it could then distribute to its customers, that Witt would not execute trades within that 60-day period. That's part of ongoing litigation in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. It's the IPO securities market manipulation case. That issue is not directly implicated here, because none of the customers here were participants in that arrangement. They simply knew that they had a restriction on their opportunity to sell stock within 60 days following the issuance of any IPO. They knew if they did, they would lose their preference in a subsequent IPO. So in fact, we had asked, because we now know that Witt was not following its rules and was not adhering to its policy of favoring non-flippers over flippers. It was not giving non-flippers the preference it said it was going to give them. We originally had a claim that those people who acquired shares in IPOs and were induced to hold in reliance upon that promise that we will give you a preference if you do not sell, that they were injured because in some instances the price of this stock 60 days later was below the IPO price. So
well,
what
if
I call
you're
going
to apply presumptions here, why shouldn't the presumption be that people abide by the rules of the game and they hold them for 60 days? And
I think that's exactly correct, Your Honor.
And
I think that's
you
the
have
presumption.
To individualize whether there's injury in fact.
I think that's the presumption that we should have, and that's why I think Duncan exactly answers the question. Because Duncan says what you do is you take the average price over that period of time, that 60-day period of time, and you compare it against the highest intermediate price. And you measure your damages by the difference between the highest intermediate price and the average price. And this court said, we recognize that in some cases it's not going to compensate people perfectly for their injury. In other cases, it may very well compensate people a bit more than they should be for their injury.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding. If the IPO is 20 and 60 days out, for some stocks it's 18. Is that right?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
So, therefore, where is the injury in fact in that circumstance?
No, Your Honor. What would happen in a case such as the one you've described? The IPO comes out at 20. It goes, in my example, to 60. And it's at 60 for some period of time during that 60-day period. And then, eventually, at the end of the 60 days, it's now at 18. The average selling price will not be the average between 18 and 20. It will probably be a bit higher. But even assuming it is, even assuming the average is $19, the highest intermediate selling price was 60. So the measure of damages under Duncan would be 60 minus 19, because Duncan says if you have a period, a restricted period, Duncan exactly answers that question. If you have a restricted period in which you cannot sell shares that you otherwise should have been allowed to sell, the measure of damages is determined by subtracting the highest intermediate price, so it would be the highest price that the stock ever rose to during that period of time from when it came out at 20 to the end of the 60th day when it was 18.
But didn't you just say otherwise should have been allowed to sell, and isn't the presumption that you hold them for 60 days?
That's the point, is that you were otherwise not allowed to sell. That Duncan addressed the question where you could not sell. And I'm saying Duncan is exactly the situation. Is if you were otherwise able to sell but could not because of something the defendants did wrong. There is a restricted period. What we think the defendants did wrong here is they told you you would get a preference for holding on to your shares. In fact, you got no preference. But the restriction existed, and Your Honor, the question you asked was, shouldn't we assume that they would have held for that entire 60-day period? And Duncan says, yes, that's what happens. You hold for the 60-day period when you can't sell, and we're going to measure the damages as the difference between the highest price during that period and the average price during the period. Now, I have said, and it is the law, and no one will contradict me, that if Witt received a sale order from a customer during that 60-day period, they were legally obligated to execute the sale. do that, Witt would have gone out, and Witt would have had to make a trade that Witt was not allowed to make. That was the problem Witt faced, because Witt had agreements with, for example, Morgan Stanley. Witt had agreements with Merrill Lynch. Witt had agreements with all the other underwriters who were taking these companies public. Witt was just distributing stock to 71,000 customers who knew nothing about that. But I think that another measure of damages which can be considered is simply to say, what was the difference between the IPO price and the first available market sale price? Because it eliminates all of this hypothesis. It eliminates all of the speculation. When would you have bought? Would you have bought? When would you have sold? What would you have sold at? How do you calculate damages? The real injury, in fact, here is you could not buy at the IPO price. If you wanted this stock, you had to buy at the next available price. And the next tick in every one of these cases is an adequate measure of damages. If you simply look at that opening tick, that very first trade after the IPO became public, and subtract that dollar, that number, take that number and subtract from it the IPO price, there's your measure of damages. It doesn't require any speculation about anything else. Would you have held? Would you have not held?
So the same fact that would establish the fact of damages would do double duty and establish the measure of damages.
If you look at that measure of damages, that's correct, Your Honor. And I do want to respond to the question. I see my time is up, but this is a very important issue that I think your question has raised. And if I may just briefly answer this one question, I won't be summing up. Assume for a moment the exact hypothetical that you and I have been discussing. The stock comes out, the IPO, the first tick is 25, again, just to use my assumption. The next available time when you're allowed to trade because of which 60-day period, the stock is now at 18. Whether you got to 18 or not because you bought at 20 or 25, you've been injured in some economic sense. If you got there from 20, you've lost $2 a share. If you got there from 25, you've lost $3 a share more. You've lost $7, I'm sorry, $5 a share more. My math isn't what it should be. If you were in a position where you had to buy or did buy at a price higher than the IPO, and many of these people, as I said, did buy in the aftermarket, then they paid more for the stock than they should have paid. So it works for people who bought and held. It works for people who didn't buy and, of course, couldn't hold because they didn't buy. Measuring the damages simply on that simple opening trade answers all of these questions. It establishes the fact of damages, and it establishes the measure of damages, and we don't even need to get into the Duncan analysis, because if you wanted to purchase, you had to buy at a price that was greater than the IPO price.
So shouldn't the class, what's your comment on this, the class be narrowed then to those who actually did purchase?
No, I don't think so. Because many of those people looked and said, well, look, I would have bought it at the IPO because one of the things I wanted to do was take advantage of the fact that everybody knew in 1999 and 2000, because every one of these IPOs was doing the same thing, that there was going to be an enormous price jump right at the beginning. I was deprived of that price jump. That was how I was injured, in fact. The next question is only a question of measuring damages, and I've already described two. If I sat here longer, I could probably describe more. But there's no question, if you had a right to buy at $2, $20, to use my same example, and you can't buy $20, and your next available purchase is at $25, you have, in fact, been injured. Whether you mitigate your damages by buying at $25 or not, I don't know. But you have, in fact, been injured. The rest of it is a question of the measure of damages, which simply does not ever defeat class certification.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Your Honors, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
There are occasions where you get a softball. This is one of them. I have the appellee's brief. Duncan is not mentioned in this brief, nor is their new theory of fact of injury that they lost out an opportunity to purchase at a lower price than the next price. Now, there are other responses to that. The plaintiffs argued Duncan before Judge Johnston on the whole claims. They did not argue it on the breach of the contract claim, nor did they argue it on the appeal here. And the reason is that Duncan was a certification from the 11th Circuit to this court to answer a question: where liability had been found, how do you measure damages? And this court answered that. But we're not talking about the measure of damages. We're talking about the liability issue. The second point on Duncan is this. Duncan, this court found that the highest intermediate price was the proper measure of damages in those particular circumstances where liability had been found. The problem is, this is a breach of contract claim governed by New York law. New York law has specifically rejected the highest intermediate price for the measure of damages. So you can't take a case which doesn't apply to New York law and bootstrap the measure of damages to the fact of injury to somehow solve the fact of injury problem. You can't do it. The second thing, which is a brand new argument today, is that their injury, the fact of injury, was the fact that they didn't get the opening price. That doesn't prove fact of injury. They still have to demonstrate when they would have sold the stock. Their allegations are that it wasn't sometimes, but invariably, the stocks always fell after 60 days. So if you could have bought at 18 or 20, but you held for 6 months or 9 months or a year, whatever your plan is, and you lost money, then you still actually benefited from not having received the allocation. The appellees have done exactly what we said they've been doing in the briefs, what they did before. They are trying to confuse the issue between fact of injury and the amount of damages. I've never stated that the amount of damages alone is necessarily a preclusion of certification. It's the first question. And by blurring it, they hope to bootstrap measure to fact of injury. But that doesn't get them around the problem. We ask the court to reverse. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. Take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.